Well, joining us now on Bloomberg Television and Radio, Bob Prince, Bridgewater Associates co-CIO. Joining us, Bob, thanks a lot. We really do appreciate your time.
Morning.
Blowout ISM number. Data continues to come in strong for the most part. If you had told me a year ago this is where we'd be, I might not believe you. We've now had trillions and trillions of dollars pumped into the U.S. economy, trillions more on the way. How do you look at it?
Well, there's been a big adrenaline shot, right? But I think more broadly, this reflects the new environment that we're in, and we're going to be in this environment for a while. It's a lot different than the world that we're used to. The way we look at it is there's been a transition to a third type of monetary policy. The first type of monetary policy, the standard, is an interest rate driven monetary policy. As interest rates approach zero, you go to QE, which is monetary policy two, and that's largely spent. And now we move to really the last remaining choice, which is the coordination of monetary policy with fiscal policy, which also starts to move in the direction of what you might call state capitalism, which is the responsibility for managing the economy, really transitioning from the central bank to some combination of the central bank and the government. And so the Biden proposals are really just reflecting that kind of inevitable change that we think has been coming, but the pandemic over the last year has brought that forward at an accelerated pace.
Bob, good morning, it's Guy. What does that mean for Bridgewater? What does that mean for investors more broadly, do you think?
Well, you have to look at the characteristics of that environment. Let's call it an MP3 environment. The key characteristics of that environment is the coordination of policy by the central bank and the fiscal, which is Congress and the president, that basically the central bank is printing the money and buying the bonds, and then the money's being distributed by the government to wherever they think it should go. Now, that changes the decision maker, the key decision maker in the system. It goes from the Federal Reserve chairman, it goes to the politicians. And so, the effectiveness of that policy, it can be a much more effective policy or a much worse policy. It all depends on the quality of that decision making. For an investor, some of the key characteristics of that environment will be a suppression of interest rates and an expansion of incomes. You're stimulating it used to be that you stimulated the economy by cutting interest rates by 3 to 5%, changing the economics of borrowing and lending, and then sort of the invisible hand would work its way through the system to stimulate growth. In this case, you can't cut the interest rates, and so the money is getting directed intentionally to where they want it to go. And that can be actually a tremendous advantage because in an interest rate driven policy, it's very hard to direct funds, let's say, to the middle income groups or the middle of the country or a particular group that needs it. Mm-hmm. But in an MP3 world, the money can be directed to particular areas. Now, on the other hand, there's much more room for bad. Right. If the decisions are bad, there could be much more damage. There could be much more currency depreciation and so forth. So it's more room for good, more room for bad.
So, Bob, let's break that apart. Let's start with the good for a second. So the way you're describing it, is that not like a green light to load up on leverage, load up on risk, load up?
Load up can be loading up too much.
Right, so how do you find that?
So I would say, don't load up too much. Specifically, there's room for, let's call it an asset liability spread between, let's say, a zero interest rate and a positive cash flow asset. Now, that's very different than buying a very low yielding zero cash flow asset, right? And so even within the equity market, you have a disparity of different types of investments. Some assets are going to be really benefited by this environment, by the supporting of the cash flows on that asset. Those have tended to not be the ones that have been in favor recently. And they could be funded at zero, essentially, or funded by selling bonds and buying those. On the other hand, that very low yield can also inflate the pricing of other assets to the point that you're highly dependent on a continued price appreciation because there is no cash flow underneath it. So it's a very potentially dangerous environment for that kind of asset, but a very beneficial environment for the cash flow asset.
Yeah. Bob, you're describing a huge range of outcomes here. Like the fan chart between kind of one of your potential scenarios and the other is enormous in terms of the returns that could be generated in there. You said something interesting a moment ago as well. You said maybe don't load up too much. Is your attitude to risk changing as a result of this? Is your attitude to leverage changing as a result of this?
Not really, because you can always move the risk of an asset up or down by borrowing or lending cash, right? So you can own a lower risk asset and raise its return and risk somewhat a little bit by borrowing and leverage. And you could actually end up with a lower risk asset than the unleveraged asset. You can take a highly, highly risky asset and reduce its risk by holding some cash. So borrowing and lending cash is just a lever that allows you, it's like a sliding scale, that allows you to adjust the risk of different kinds of assets, which we've done for a long time, both in our alpha strategies and in our beta strategies.
So it does seem, though, when you look at the range of outcomes, a lot of that's going to depend on inflation, which kind of speaks to the whole, like, where the money is going and if it's going to the right spot. It seems to be developing into somewhat of a binary outcome for inflation when it comes to what investors are looking at. What do you see, and how do you deal with that as an investor?
Well, there's a lot more potential to create inflation through this MP3 type of a policy because you can literally put money into people's hands to go spend, right? And you can choose whose hands you put it in. And so there's more potential for inflation. But the question is inflation of what? And so you've already had inflation of asset prices, and the QE2 world, the QE world was inflated asset prices a lot because that's where the money went. Whether we have a secular rise in inflation, it depends on a lot of other forces. It's not just a U.S. question, it's a global question. 80% of the countries around the world have an inflation rate of less than 3%. Central banks have been very successful at bringing down inflation over the last 40 years. Globalization has reduced the cost of labor and kept it there. So you have low inflation and stable inflation is a global phenomenon. That's just not just a U.S. phenomenon. So if you were going to have a rise in inflation, it would probably have to be global. And other countries are not stimulating to the extent that the U.S. is. So that's much, and particularly China. China's in sort of a steady state. On the other hand, any given country's inflation rate can also be impacted by their currency. So if you had dollar depreciation, that could raise U.S. inflation rates relative to other countries' inflation rates. In fact, it would be deflationary for other economies. And so the inflation question, I think, is just more complex than a 0-1 type of thing. However, the thing that we can say, A, more potential, but B, that the existence of inflation will be one of the key constraints on whether the MP3 world and whether the central bank, whether the Fed, will continue to have the latitude to pursue these policies. Without inflation, they have a lot of latitude to, as well as the government, to continue these policies. But with inflation and currency depreciation, they start to hit the roadblocks and the constraints.
For our audience on radio, you're listening to Bridgewater's Bob Prince. Bob, what does this mean for returns? What kind of returns are you guys targeting in this new kind of environment? Is it different to the kind of return structure that you expected before? It's been a very turbulent time. Your returns have been hit. Do you expect them in this new environment to pick up from here?
If you just look at the returns of assets as they come packaged, they're likely to be low. You start with the yield on cash. You have a negative yield on cash, a negative real yield on cash. And that's been a source of actually wealth destruction in the last 10 years of about 15%. Now you have negative real yields on bonds. And all assets compete with cash and bonds. So the yields of other assets are also coming down. Looking backward, that has elevated their prices. But looking forward, that's reduced their expected returns. So we're going into a world where the whole return structure has dropped. And that's particularly relevant in the let's say the U.S. and Europe and in the West, where they're faced with the zero interest rate problem. When you go to China, and when you go to Asia and you go to the East, you don't have that issue. You have a decade coming of relatively high productivity growth. You have the potential to use all the normal policy levers. And they haven't blown out their fiscal balance sheet. They've kept the virus under control through other means. So we shouldn't just look at the world through the eyes of the West. We should look at the investing world globally. And we think in terms of actually balancing East and West in terms of your exposures and recognizing the unique risks, but also the unique opportunities in those two worlds. They're very different in the nature of their opportunities. And so you really want to be working with both hands on both sides of the world in an investment portfolio.
So how in both of those? Like China, PBOC wants to open the bond market to get more foreign investors. Yet at the same time, China cracks down on Jack Ma and fintech. Here in the U.S., everyone's loving SPACs and Bitcoin until they don't. So, like, how do you play that barbell?
Well, like I said, I think align yourself with the policies is very important, right? So if in the West, it's really the cash flow the assets that benefit from the boost in cash flow from nominal spending, nominal income rising, from the distribution of the monetization into people's hands, and funded with the negative real interest rate. That's essentially at least for right now, that's the path. But when you go to Asia and China, it's very different because if you look at China and look at the 5-year plan and referred to dual circulation, you have a very rapid development of an internal economy there. And what we see is commonplace everyday industries in the West, those are going to be growth industries in many cases in China because they didn't exist in China. And so they go from not existing to existing as they move to a more balanced, internally oriented economy. So there's a lot of room for security selection and industry positioning and so forth in that part of the world, and benefiting from high productivity growth, 5-6% productivity growth. Over in the West, you're looking at 0.5-1.5% productivity growth and 0 negative interest rates. Very, very radically different circumstances, but really no tightening of monetary policy anywhere. And so that's generally a good environment for investing generally, but you have to adapt to this world that we're in. It's a new world.
What's a good store of value in this new world, Bob?
Well, I think a store of value, it's different ways of looking at a store of value. You have to start out with where's wealth being destroyed today, and where's the potential for it to be destroyed, and avoid that. Wealth is being destroyed right now in, let's say, bonds, T-bills and treasury bonds. They're no longer an investment asset. They're a funding asset. And so that will eventually spread to other assets and drive their yields down. Dollar-denominated bonds to a foreign investor will be, relatively unattractive as the yields are low and the money's being printed. So these are potential areas of wealth destruction. In terms of wealth preservation, diversification is key. There's no one asset through the history. We've studied the last 200 years of different policy shifts and panics and so forth. And over 200 years, there's never been a single asset that did not have a 50 to 80% decline in its purchasing power within the course of a decade. Every single asset at one time or another has, including cash, has had a 50 to 80% decline in its value in terms of purchasing power within a decade. That means there is no one answer. It has to be a diversified answer. And the best way to diversify is to diversify a portfolio with respect to ups and downs in growth, and mm-hmm. diversify a portfolio with respect to ups and downs in inflation. If you look at the equity market, your storeholds of wealth are going to be assets whose revenues and cash flow streams are not susceptible to the economic cycle, or which have very strong balance sheets and get to the other side of a downturn. Mm-hmm. So go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, I want to hear more, but I was going to say, it sounds like Bitcoin could be in there.
Bitcoin can be a little bit of a sliver, but a little bit of a sliver is a lot of risk anyway. So Bitcoin and gold are alternative currencies, right? And so, and you want to think about gold as an alternative to currency, and Bitcoin is sort of coming along as another one of those alternatives to paper money. And therefore, it can be in a diversified storeholder wealth portfolio. It can have a little bit of a sliver.
Bob, how different is your firm going to be post-pandemic, just in the way it operates, just in the way you bring people back in, working from home? How different a world are we now moving into, and how is that going to affect the way that you work?
Well, you know, ironically, in some ways, we've been more productive in the last year than we ever were, and in other ways, way less. Obviously, the culture of a community is very hard to build when you're not actually seeing each other. So we're going to a blend. We expect to go to a blend where there's a certain number of days in the week that everybody's actually in an office, but it's a lot less. It's less than it used to be. But also coordinating those days in the office so that the things that are best done sitting together in a room can be done sitting together in a room, while at the same time allowing some of the flexibility and actually potential for focus that's created, you know, working from an alternative location. So as well as lifestyle flexibility. So we're just going to be adding more flexibility to the program. And essentially incorporating a blend of the different approaches and experiences.
Bob, we really appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing so much of it with us today, 1 year on from the start of this pandemic. Looking forward, Bob Prince, Bridgewater Associates, co-CIO. Thank you very much indeed.